Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today being the full moon of the month of February in our calendar, but Magga in the Pali calendar. And so we talk about Magga Puja. As I mentioned this morning, it's the occasion when we recollect the auspicious gathering of 1,250 fully enlightened beings coming to pay their respects, spend time with their teacher, the Lord Buddha. This is not a small thing. You realize, we all realize, I'm sure, how difficult it is just to make an effort to free our hearts for a few moments from these states, from greed and from aversion and from delusion, how the force of habit and momentum behind these wild, unruly passions that keep tripping us up. And the effort that it takes to transform greed, aversion and delusion into wisdom, compassion and purity is not a small thing. And so certainly anybody who manages to do it is profoundly worthy of respect. And that there have been such beings in the world is a wonderful blessing. And that we have the teachings that the Buddha and his disciples have left us is indeed a great blessing. For how else would we deal with the confusion? The stories that our minds create about when we feel greedy is what? Yeah. Like that cheesecake at the meal today with passion fruit topping. Yeah. It was just, you just look at it and the mind comes up with a story about how much you need to eat it. And it's so attractive and your body reacts and says, well, the others didn't take much, I should take two pieces. Create stories as soon as desire arises and we don't understand desire, then it's like a tense consciousness, it distorts consciousness. It's like there's a distortion, a warp. And so that when we look at something, even if it's unattractive, we think it becomes attractive. We think it's attractive. When there's desire unrecognized in the mind, there's desire, no wisdom, then we see things that are not really attractive and not really worth hanging on to as something we should hang on to, like the body. Yeah. You can look at certain aspects of the body and you can see it's got some beautiful aspects. Some bodies can appear as beautiful, but you don't have to look very deep or smell very much before the whole thing is really quite disgusting. The body is not actually inherently beautiful. It's got some beautiful aspects to it, but it's got some really disgusting aspects to it. But when the mind is filled with desire and there's no wisdom, then we see otherwise. We see things that are not really attractive as attractive. And likewise with ill will. When the wild passions flare up and there's resentment and ill will, then our nearest and dearest friend can become an enemy. Yeah. Or like ourselves, we can be our own nearest and dearest friend and take good care of ourselves and look after ourselves. But for some people, when there's so much ill will arises and there's no mindfulness, no wisdom, what happens is they want to kill themselves. It's a distortion, it's a warp in consciousness, a disfigurement of consciousness. And delusion, perhaps the worst of all, because at least with greed and aversion, you know there's something there. You say, all right, there's greed, you can reflect on it. With ill will, you know, oh yeah, there's ill will, that's bad stuff, that hurts. But with delusion, the trouble with delusion is you don't even know you're deluded. That's really tricky. Only with hindsight, you look back and say, wow, was I ever deluded? Yeah. And that's one reason why we need good friends and why we need good teachers, because people who are less deluded than us can offer us a reflection. When we're caught up in some delusion, thinking that something's really worth hanging on to when it's not, or thinking that it's right to follow our anger when it's not, it's only causing suffering for ourselves and others. Those who are less deluded than we are can see that, and they say, well, you could look at it from another perspective. Not because they're judging us, but just because they see. It's like when somebody's drunk and you're not drunk, you know, or somebody's on drugs and you're not taking drugs, and say, wow, this person's really got a funny take on things, and they've really got a distorted perspective. And for them, it's absolutely real. Yeah, absolutely real, having all sorts of convincing mind states. But from your perspective, your condition is not so warped. So, well, don't be so sure about that. So we're very fortunate that we've had the great teachers. We've got the teachings of the Buddha and the great teachers that have followed in his path to pass these instructions, these guidelines down to us. And on this occasion, Magga Puja, one aspect of the Buddha's teachings which we traditionally reflect upon, which is called the Owada Patimokkha, which is the Buddha gave on this occasion when these 1,250 fully enlightened beings came to see him. They didn't have any distortions. They didn't have any warps in their consciousness. They didn't need to be told what to do. But as a celebration of the auspiciousness of the occasion, the Buddha gave this profound teaching. And at the end of it, he pointed out, this is not just from this Buddha, not just from Gautama Buddha, but this is a teaching from all Buddhas. All Buddhas give the same teaching. So there's one section of it which is very well known, particularly well known, and not just in Theravadan tradition, but also in other Buddhist traditions as well. And the Pali version of it goes, Sabba papasa akkaranang kusalasa upasampada satchita pariyotapanang etang buddhana sasanang. And you will have heard the translation, I'm sure. It says, refrain from doing that which is evil. Cultivate that which is good. Purify the heart. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Now, a simple four-line teaching like that, maybe, well, you know, what's next? That doesn't sound so great. You know, refrain from doing evil and cultivate the good, purify the heart. Oh, yeah, that's okay. What else? Well, I would suggest and encourage ourselves to look a little bit more deeply, to really listen to this teaching and to see if we can catch the message that the Buddha was giving. It's a profound message, and on many levels, whether you're starting out in practice or in the middle of practice or you're the last stages of practice, this pattern, this paradigm, if you like, still applies. Sabba papasa akkaranam kusalasa upasampada, the first two lines. Refrain from doing that which is papa kamma, entirely the word bab. Bab, mai tam dikwa. If you know that there's something unskillful, unwholesome, some papa kamma, then to refrain from doing it. Kusalasa upasampada. To cultivate that which is kusala, kusun, to make much of that. And the sequence of these is significant. Perhaps some of you have experienced the consequences of practicing meditation or spiritual disciplines before you really had down enough restraint. I know in my own early life as a meditator, I went on my meditation retreat and living on a hippie commune and surrounded by all sorts of freaks, getting up to all sorts of things. And although I stopped smoking, taking drugs by that point, they hadn't. And And I also had all sorts of heedless habits. And coming back from meditation retreat, the wonderful experience of what meditation could offer, but not having sense restraint is very dangerous, really. Can lead to great confusion. It's not difficult to use a little willpower to focus our attention on the end of your nose and concentrate and concentrate until the mind drops into some slightly altered state of becomes more focused, and you see things differently. You feel the stress, the tension, the distress, the dis-ease fall away, and so it's definitely a beautiful experience. But to be able to really integrate that into daily life, to really live that from that perspective, is something else altogether. When you're sitting on a meditation cushion, surrounded by other people being very mindful and focused, and it's somewhat easier to exercise in that way. But when you go back out into everyday activity and the television, the sights, the shapes, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, and you walk past a pastry shop and the fragrance that comes out, and you want to go in, you don't go in. I was in London yesterday, and the acupuncturist that I was going to see was late, and I was standing outside his clinic, and right next door was this, I think it was a French patisserie, and the fragrances that were coming out, at one stage I just had a little look around the door and to see what was inside, and the subtle lighting and the shapes and the spark, everything was just so seductive. Well, as a monk without any money, it was quite easy not to go in and get anything. But if I had money, I saw these people walking by and they would stop and hesitate, and then they'd go in and get something. The ability to say no to ourselves, not just as a willful exercise, that's not difficult for a while, we can be willful, but to say no mindfully is a real skill and a very important discipline. And preparing ourselves for the third line of the stanza, purification of the heart. We might start out by thinking, oh, give me the answer. I want to hear the ultimate teaching. I want to purify the heart, free from ignorance. I want to realize the unshakable insight of the Buddha and have wisdom and compassion and purity and be done with it. And go straight to the third line and try to do that. But it really doesn't work like that. As with anything else in life, there needs to be preparation. And the preparation for the spiritual life is, one of the main preparations is sense restraint. In this case, in this verse, restraining from doing that which is unwholesome. Sabbapapasa akaranang. Akaranang is better not to do it. Sabbapapasa, all unwholesomeness, better not to do it. Restraining oneself from doing that which is unwholesome. Not rushing to the next line of doing good. Living in Thailand for a number of years, I saw a good number of people who rushing to the monastery to do good, to tambun, to create kusala, to make lots of offerings, and the rich people make lots of expensive offerings. But then they go away and they do not such good things after all. Like when Ajahn Chah was in America, and he was teaching a retreat at the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Massachusetts, and he listened to their stories, these young American meditators, and he said, oh, I don't see the point really in talking to you, really. He said, you think you can come sit here on meditation retreat for a few days and just settle it. I've been in a monastery since I was a boy. It takes years to work on this stuff. He said, you're treating me just like a smart lawyer. He says, you're getting around creating all sorts of crime, doing all sorts of offences, and then you get busted and put in jail, and then you employ me to come and bust you out of jail again. He said, what you really got to do is stop committing all the crimes. Or he said, you're like a boxer. Thais like boxing. Just like English people are crazy about football, Thais are crazy about boxing. Even monks are crazy about boxing. And Ajahn Chah used the image. He said, you're like punch-drunk boxers who've been thumped around so much and all bruised that you've got to come here and take a break and recover. But I know as soon as you recover, you're going to go back out there and get in a fight again. And the point he was making was that just getting a little peaceful or reading some books or listening to some talks and getting a little understanding going is not really enough to really integrate insight, to really cultivate the path. What's needed is the first stage of practice, which is sabba papasa akarana, restraining from doing that which is unwholesome by body, speech and mind, to really develop the sense of restraint, sangvara indriya. Yeah. If we don't do this with our body and speech, then with our meditation, we can only get to a certain point and then the mind won't stop, it'll just go off again. Sangvara indriya is all the senses, six senses, the sense restraint on all six bases. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touches and mental impressions. So if we're not willing to exercise restraint with regards to the body and speech, the things we look at, and when we look at something, you can look at something and the heart energy can come out and go out through the eyes and you can lust after it, like something, some very beautiful sight or some very beautiful sound. And if you're mindful, you can feel this happening where the heart energy comes up and goes out after the sense object and tastes. I have a friend in America who does courses in mindful eating, and she's very disappointed to see what's taught in some Buddhist circles in America with regards to mindful eating. And she was saying how they don't reflect on the process of eating and how this is just medicine for the body, but rather they reflect on when you're biting an apple, you listen to the crispness of the apple as you bite into it, and then the zing-zang flavor of the apple as you taste it. And, well, is that really mindfulness? It sounds pretty much to me like indulging in sensuality, going out after the sense object with sounds. There's some beautiful sounds. You can listen to a piece of Beethoven, or whatever you get off on, Beethoven's Ninth. What an extraordinary feat that somebody could create such an absolute masterpiece. And no doubt about it, it's phenomenal. It's like a cathedral. It's the most magnificent construction. But if the heart energy comes up and goes out after it, well, it might be okay for a while, but what happens when you're faced with a really ugly sound or a really ugly taste or a really ugly sight to look at? So sight, sound, smells, touches, if we're still indulging and following these sense impressions and losing ourselves in them, then that's what happens with the mind door, the sense base of the mind as well, that we can't help but follow these things. The thoughts come up of the past and the mind follows them, doubts, worries, fears. And most of us come to spiritual life with such a habit of indulgence that we think it's normal. But from the perspective of those who are well established on the path or who've lived a more modest life than most of us did, we're in a state of serious dysfunctionality. We've really got some work to do. And so it's of primary importance that we understand this teaching of the Buddha, that sense restraint comes first. This is the first step. We may be able to have some experiences with samadhi, but it's very unlikely that they're going to really deepen and be integrated until we come back and recognize the place of sense restraint. Now, one of the reasons why this is not taught very much is because it comes very close to triggering a feeling of being repressed, repressing sense desires. And, most of us have grown up in a society where there's been an excess of that already, and we don't want to fall into that trap, repressing desires, repressing anger. But the Buddha taught the middle way, which is between indulgence and repression. We know what repression is like. We need to investigate and say, well, this is what indulgence is. This is where the heart energy comes up and leaps out and lands on the object, and you feel like, I've just got to have that. That is where we've lost ourselves. When that happens, whatever the object is, including the mind base, you're sitting there and a creative idea comes up and you say, I've just got to follow this. And that's it. We've lost ourselves. A good barometer for practice that I learnt from a book I read from Reverend Kenneth Roshi, the founder of Shastra Abbey in Strathfield Hall, when I was a one Pansar monk. She pointed out in her book, Don't Push the River, I think it was called, she said something like, if you have to follow the impulse, then it's not mindful action. If you can't choose to not follow it, then it's better to wait. And I found that a very, very helpful barometer. Like with speaking, you know, should I say something, should I not say something? Well, ask yourself, can I choose to not say something? Or with taking a second piece of cheesecake, can I choose to not take a second piece of cheesecake? If you can choose to not take a second piece of cheesecake, it might be all right to have a second piece of cheesecake. So if we can use that, we can establish that in our minds as a training, where we feel, should I follow this or should I not follow? We'll just first see, can we choose to say no? When we can really say no to ourselves, when we can say we've got this faculty, we've got this psychic muscle in place where we can protect ourselves by saying no to the impulses, the wild passions leap up, and we just say no to ourselves, and we know we can trust ourselves. When we've got that containment, there's a tremendous inner strength there, an inner security. Like, you know, if you ever had the experience where, as a child, where maybe you've been subjected to a little bullying, and then you go and do some working out, and you grow up a bit, and then you find that actually now you're bigger than the bully, and you're really healthy, and the bully's smaller than you are, and you actually look at them and say, well, actually, I could take him out now. Because I've got the strength. You know that you can defend yourself. Well, likewise, so it is with the senses. If we don't know that we can say no, something within us really knows we can't really say yes. Not in all honesty, we're not really safe to say yes if we can't say no. So we need to build up that strength. So it's not incidental that the Buddha gave this verse, starting with refraining from that which is unwholesome, unskillful. Yeah. And then cultivating the good. The image that Ajahn Chah used to use in Thailand was, because we used to dye our robes there. We were given white cloth and we would dye our robes with Gankanun. And it takes a lot of work to make this this liquor from jackfruit. You've got to chop up the jackfruit. It takes ages and ages to chop up the heartwood of the jackfruit and tree, and then you boil it and you extract the resin and you concentrate it down, and after you've spent days, weeks creating this good liquor, this good dye, then you put your white cloth in it and you dye it. But as Ajahn Chah pointed out, is if the fabric is not properly prepared, if it's dirty cloth, then the dye's not going to stick. The dye won't take. One of my jobs before I became a monk, I used to be a technician in a laboratory in a big dyeing factory, which actually was dyeing miles of fabric in particular precise colours, and there was a lot of the work was actually preparing the cloth so that it was susceptible to the dye stuff. That if you don't prepare the cloth properly, then the molecule of the dye doesn't attach to the fabric, and as soon as you wash it, then it comes off. The chemical process doesn't take, so it doesn't stick. Well, so is the psychic process of cultivating the good and purifying the heart. It's not going to stick, it's not going to take if we don't prepare the ground, if we don't prepare our hearts with sense restraint. So preparation is of primary importance. Not moral judgment, not saying, you know, we should be just holding back on desires and out of will, but no, using mindfulness, using wise reflection to consider carefully, you know, what are the consequences of following sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches, and see how this impacts on the mind. When you've been on retreat for a week and you've been exercising restraint with sight, sound, smells, tastes, touches and mental impressions by meditating on the meditation object, and then you come to the state at the end of the retreat, how does it feel? It feels cooler, feels calmer. More sensitive, the body feels more alert. Yeah. That's the result of having done right preparation. So then the second phase, or the second point of this teaching, cultivating that which is good, that recognizing that we do need to build up wholesome potential. Yeah, we can, again, we can, if we don't have a balanced education, we can come to this training with a distorted perspective, thinking that just because we can think good thoughts that we can actualize them. Being able to think good thoughts is very different from actualizing what you're thinking about. Yeah. Like going against ill will. You can read the teachings and read what the Buddha said about it, read what the great teachers have said about it, and you can contemplate it. But when you're faced with the passions, when somebody offends you or hurts you, betrays you, and that wild, molten lava comes to the surface, that rage is there. Have we got the strength, have we got the ability to contain it? Or does it come out through our body and speech, not to mention mind? So there are lots of good qualities that we also need to develop, like loving kindness. We can't just imagine our way to liberation. We need to create the conditions that are suitable. Remember, we're not talking about making ourselves enlightened, but we are doing something to make ourselves susceptible to understanding, susceptible to insight. We're preparing the ground so we become susceptible to Dhamma by refraining from doing that which is unwholesome, and by cultivating the good, and by cultivating purity, loving kindness, patience. Sometimes these qualities can appear quite wimpish or insignificant. But if you really exercise the effort to cultivate loving kindness, remembering also the Buddha points out we need to have it equally with ourselves and all beings, loving kindness. You know, that image that he gave where you're in a forest and there's you, your best friend, somebody you feel neutral about, and your enemy. And then these bunch of brigands come and get you, and one of you is going to be tortured or killed. Don't remember the story exactly, but it's up to you to decide which one of the four, you, your best friend, somebody you're neutral about, and your worst enemy, which one of the four is going to be sacrificed to this gang of murderers. Which one? You've got to decide. And then your mind scans and you go, maybe this one. Maybe this. You know what the Buddha said? The Buddha said, if your mind has preference for any one of those four, you don't understand my teaching. What we tend to probably do is think, oh, I've got to sacrifice myself because that's the good thing to do. Whether we would do that or not is another matter, but that's probably what we would like to think right now. Well, the Buddha said, no, that's not it. If you're having your mind moves in preference for any one of those four, you think any one of those four is more worthy of being tortured and murdered than the others, then you don't understand my teaching. In other words, loving kindness is when you extend it to all beings. And it's profoundly important when we're cultivating, when we move to the next level of practice, purification of the heart, to have the sense of well-wishing for ourselves, to really wish ourselves well. When we're faced with the demons and the demon of doubt, the demon of guilt, the demon of rage, the demon of lust, these demons, these dragons, when they come up and they blow their fiery smoke at us and we get confused and our vision is clouded and we're sweating and the heart is pumping and we don't know what's going on. And well, if we've already cultivated a heart of loving kindness, a heart of well-wishing, it's a tremendous force, protection. It protects the heart from fear. Fear is a form of aggression. And if we've protected our heart with loving kindness, well, then that impulse to become afraid is inhibited. Or patience, likewise, cultivating the good of patience. What is patience anyway? I mean, patience is nothing. You're not doing anything. You're not getting anywhere with patience. You're not becoming anything great. You can't advertise, I'm so patient. Not like samadhi or psychic powers or something. Patience doesn't seem like much. But the Buddha called it, actually, the ultimate practice for burning out the defilements. The ultimate practice, patient endurance, is the ultimate practice for burning out. And Ajahn Chah used to say that in the end, there's just patience. Tengti sokkami otoan taunana. thương tiếc cũng có thể ổn toàn thân an. We can have loving kindness, we can have wisdom, we can have some insights and all these things, but that doesn't necessarily deal with the obstructions we have to ignorance, to seeing beyond ignorance. Sometimes we just have to bear with the momentum, the kama vipaka, the momentum of our past heedlessness. We just have to bear with it. Maybe we've had some understanding, maybe we've seen a little bit. Maybe we have tremendous faith, tremendous energy, tremendous zeal, tremendous interest in seeing Dhamma. But the conditions are not right yet for the veils of delusion to fall away. And so what do? Do we keep hammering away and trying to sort it? Well, that doesn't work. We can actually make things worse, stir things up. Sometimes we've got to turn to this ultimate practice of patient endurance, kwam otorn. It doesn't sound like much. It's not like cultivating samadhi, something that we can advertise or feel good about. But if we really recollect, really reflect on it, well, then actually we can feel very good about it. We can make a practice out of it. And when you're having a bad time, say, well, this is the only situation in which I can cultivate patience. You can't cultivate patience when you're having a great time. And the Buddha said patience is the ultimate practice. So what are we going to do? When we're having a really bad time, when conditions are really disagreeable, say, this is it. This is the opportunity for me to develop patience. I can't understand what's going on. I've tried. I've talked to other people, and they can't get rid of it. Loving kindness. Well, I don't feel any loving kindness. I just hate everybody, including myself. I hate the universe. Wish I'd never been born. What can you do? Well, you can still exercise patient endurance. And patient endurance is very different from bitter endurance. Bitter endurance is what the uninitiated, the beginners, practice. They just kind of grit their teeth and say, I'm going to put up with this because Ajahn Indu said it's good for me, or the Buddha said it's the ultimate practice. Nobody with any sense said that bitter endurance is good practice. Patient endurance is kindly bearing with. Like with a child, when a child's growing up, think, for goodness sake, when are you going to grow up? You know, a little two-year-old learning to walk, you wouldn't do that to a child. Yeah. A child, this child, well, only 2 years old, they don't know how to manage their own bank account yet. They don't know that sugar's bad for them, and so you don't necessarily get angry at them because they want more sugar. You just got to find an intelligent way of steering them away from sugar. You don't hit them and beat them and tell them to grow up and be more responsible. You realize, well, this is a two-year-old. Yeah. Well, likewise, in our own hearts, that as we are all beginners in practice, then we have that same kindly attitude as we would towards a child. That's what the Buddha said. If you want to follow me, you've got to emulate a mother with her only child. That's the kind of love and care that we need to exercise towards ourselves, towards all beings. Yeah. And compassion. Sometimes you can't manage to get any loving kindness going, but you can work on compassion. Compassion is slightly different. It's still a positive state of heart, positive state of mind, but this is in the context of experiencing suffering. With loving kindness, it's may beings be well, may I be well. There needs to be a certain sense of positivity there already. But with compassion, it's may beings be free from suffering. Even when we're in the midst of suffering, even when we ourselves are really suffering, we can imagine somebody we love and care about suffering. And automatically the heart gives rise to this wish, may they be free from suffering. May my mother be free from suffering. May my friend, whoever, may they be free from suffering. And when that heart felt that warmth, that natural warmth of heart comes up, and then with the thought of may they be free from suffering, that becomes our object of meditation, our object of recollection. May beings be free from suffering. May I be free from suffering. What a wonderful thing to wish for ourselves. May I be free from suffering. We're absolutely 100% allowed to do that. Yeah. So many people are crippled with self-hate, self-loathing, and feeling like they haven't got the resources to carry on. Well, it's tragic that they haven't had the spiritual and they haven't been introduced to the spiritual teaching, which shows them that you can wish yourself well. It doesn't matter how bad things are going. May I be free from suffering is a wonderful thing to think for yourself. So cultivating that which is good, refraining from that which is unskillful, unwholesome, cultivating that which is good. This is the preparation. Now we've done the preparation. Then the purification of the heart is can be seen as the cultivation of wisdom, insight, which sees that any form of attachment, even attaching to that which is good, is still not it. And it's like the image we have of when you wash dirty clothes and the clothes are clean, but they still have the smell of the soap powder, they're still not really clean. Yeah. So even though we might put a lot of effort into our spiritual practice, make a lot of effort with our precepts, sense restraint, cultivating that which is good, cultivating heart of loving kindness, patience, generosity, forgiveness. But there can still be the taint of clinging and the conceit of I am good. I am better than they are. And so this is not pure. But to be able to see the taint of clinging, to be able to have the mindfulness, to have the presence of attention at the moment when the heart is contracting and grasping into me and mine and you and yours and creating the world and all the misery and the suffering that comes from that creation, to have the presence of attention in the body, in the heart, in the mind, takes a lot of preparation. Yeah, we might be able to understand the theory, and we may have met some people somewhere who have some realization, which is very inspiring. But for us to actualize this teaching, the purification of the heart, we need to put emphasis in the preparation. And then the verse ends with that wonderful, what I find, that wonderful, inspiring statement from the Buddha says, this is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So not just our Buddha, not just Gautama Buddha, but all the Buddhas have taught the same paradigm, the same pattern. And on whatever level of practice we're at, whether we're just starting out or whether we've been at it for a while or whether we're really well advanced in practice, this theme, this pattern still applies. So on this occasion of Magga Puja, I'd like to offer these thoughts for your contemplation. Thank you for your attention.